All right. I am really excited to bring this one to you guys today. I'm going to be speaking with James LaBrie of the band Dream Theater. What we'll learn, if you don't already know, is how much more extensively his career expands beyond just the Dream Theater work. And James and I have a relationship that goes back a ways, and I've got some stories that I'm going to tell that he hasn't heard. I think will be fun for him. But he's, let me give him a quick intro. There are many lists online. You can see Music Radar and other places where they do this thing where they pull rock and metal communities for favorite vocalists. And James makes these lists again and again and again for his work. He's been on lists for the greatest vocalist of all time. And we'll get into some of that later. One of the top metal singers of all time. Of course, he's been part of Dream Theater that has twice been nominated for a Grammy. There's a lot to be said about Dream Theater in its sophomore effort, really finding its stride as a consequence of James joining the band. We'll talk about that. And he's got a career in a very, very difficult industry that spanned 35 years, which by itself is a testimony to his work ethic and his gift. So without further ado, let me bring on James LaBrie. There he is. Sir.
Wow, what an introduction, Peter. I'll send you the check later on today. Wow. No, that's cool, man. I appreciate that.
Yeah. 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 Well deserved. I want to tell a quick story to frame the whole rest of our discussion. I was a fan from almost the very beginning. I mean, by which I mean, I had heard When Dream and Day Unite, which was just prior to. And then you came to the group, and one of the interesting things about your fan base is there's a lot of musicians and a lot of accomplished musicians.
Yeah.
And this has the interesting effect of a lot of people who really acknowledge the expertise in the band and the songwriting, the way you approach the songs, all of these things. But it also has the consequence of folks who can get sort of in your business about critique, which isn't in and of itself bad. It's not the kind of fan community that all bands have. And it's because you guys are where you are as musicians. Mm-hmm. There was a listserv, a mailing list way, way back called Yitzy Jam.
Yeah.
And there was a thread that got rolling where people were, you know, you'd missed a note or something live, which.
I'm under the microscope all the time, Peter.
All the time. And there's not a singer on the planet. On the planet ever, who hasn't missed a note. And because of Dream Theater and kind of this regard that you have, which is, I think, comes from mostly a good place, they just started to kind of go at you. And so I had been training, I'd moved to Seattle to train with a guy by the name of David Kyle. And it was a serious voice training. I'd been at it a while. And so I started to watch this happen, and I jumped on that list, and I went into all of this explanation of, you know, even in opera, there's this notion they have of the 9 C's, where even the best opera tenors, that was a big deal if they would hit 9 C's. It was made news when Pavarotti did that. Now look at what James does every night on just a grueling tour with the catalog. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't trying to get into a fight. I just wanted to try and enlarge the perspective of the conversation. And I just did that because of how much I appreciate what you do as a vocalist. And you sent me a mail, and it was the most surprising, delightful email I ever received. And you just said, I just appreciate you, you know, jumping on there to say a few words. And that's where our friendship began.
Yeah. And, you know, I distinctly remember that period of time. You actually reached out to me. You were probably a blessing in disguise because, you know, I just recently had my vocal injury where I'd ruptured my cords there, and I bled and all that from food poisoning. And I was basically being lambasted, you know, every night, and being raked over the coals. And I was just trying to get back to, you know, being strong and consistent again. And it was extremely difficult because, as you mentioned earlier, you know, our touring is grueling. It's not a friend for a singer, that's for sure. Because we're doing on average 3 nights and then a night off, three nights, night off, you know. I'm like, you know, so you're looking at five or six shows every week, and you're out there for 7 weeks. So anyways, long story short, you know, it's something that I've really had to come to terms with, because trust me, on my own, there's been many moments that I go, you know, like, why did it have to happen? Why did I have to get that food poisoning? Why did I have to be so violently ill that, you know, if anything, you know, if I'd have been a guitar player, who cares? You know, I could have been that sick and no one would have been the wiser. But being a vocalist and doing that to your instrument, you know, I lost a lot of my power. I lost a lot of my just being able to wake up every morning and be able to sing like a bird. It was not a problem. And then all of a sudden it was a challenge, and it had never been a challenge for me ever in my life before. You know, it was just there from the time I was a kid. I was able to just sing, you know? Yeah. So all of a sudden I walked into this prison, and it was very difficult for me to wrap my head around and then deal with the negativity that was out there. So, but you know what, I had to reach deep within and transcend all that, you know, and just say, look, you know, just go out there and give it all you've got. And, you know, I think everyone wants to focus on when you're having an off night, but then they don't see all the other great nights. So that's fine. That's human nature.
I was going to say, I've seen you guys countless times, mm-hmm. And there isn't any of those nights when there was something that I thought was off. In fact, there was a tour you came through Seattle, and you guys were at the end of a very long evening, no opener, mm-hmm. just you guys for 2+ hours. And the last song, I think you came on for an encore, but the last song of the set was Illumination Theory. And I thought, no way did they do that to James. No way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then yeah. you just nailed it. You found a gear in that song. And I was just, I was floored. I you know, and this sounds like me just, you know, because I am a huge fan of your voice, but I believe I've developed enough objectivity about voice to look at it for more than just.
Well, you're a great singer yourself. So you have an ear for that. There's no doubt about it. Like that is your instrument as well. So you're very attuned to that. I mean, I love your voice. I mean, I don't know how many people out there have heard Peter, but he has an incredible voice. And so I appreciate that. It's not just you coming from an angle like, oh yeah, man, I think you got a cool voice. It's like, you do it too. You realize what it takes to get there, to maintain it, to sustain it, and to be able to go out there night after night after night. And I think, you know, the crazy thing with me, Peter, is as a singer, and even I remember John Petrucci saying, it's so bizarre. He says, the longer you sing, the stronger you get. It's really weird. And I go, yeah, I know. And it's funny because when we actually put the song list together for any tour, I go, okay, guys, so listen, if we can start with these songs. And it's almost like, you know what I mean? You're warming up for a workout. Even though I warm up before I go on stage, I'll go, well, these songs, they're more like in that mid-range. That's cool, you know, whatever. Let's start with that. And then let's save the freaking huge ones. And let's save the ones where I'm screaming my head off. Let's save that for later. Let's save that for the second set. And they're like, yeah, okay, all right, that's fine with them. And it's funny because some of the songs that we're saving for the end for me, the other guys will be like, oh man, that's a grueling tune. Like, as far as they go, you know, and like Mike Mangini, Mike, oh my God, man, I'm going ballistic on that tune. And it's like, but you know, you're not out there right in the front singing, and I got to think about my voice. So it's pretty funny because where other singers, they love to come on and go, I'm going to give you my best at the beginning of the night, and then we'll trail off as the night goes, you know?
Yeah. You do. You have this uncanny ability to kind of hit this other gear the deeper you go. It's mm-hmm. and the regimen is just athletic. The music, you start many of the songs, and I think this is something that's deceptively unacknowledged in the Dream Theater catalog, is there's a great mm-hmm. many of the songs that just start at a sort of higher register compared to others. So if you're going to sort of extend upwards, you're already kind of doing some athletic work. And I know that one of the ways I've been trying to stay warm as a vocalist during COVID is I've been singing some of your songs. Mm-hmm. And there's some of those songs I'm just like, he's starting at places in many of those tunes that other singers top out.
Right. That's so right. Anyway, that's right. You know, it's funny because I've had some other, I guess, vocal teachers along the way, like where I'll be out and then they, you know, they somehow get in contact with me and they'll come to the show and they come back and they go, you know, oh my God, man, I was just watching for the last 3 hours. How did you do that? And I go, well, you know, I warm up very slowly. And then I cool down. I make sure that I cool down every night. But I, you know, like the one guy was saying, he's like, well, you know, you started with Untethered Angel. And he goes, you're going way up there, you know, right to begin with. How do you do that? And I go, well, believe it or not, this is how I go about that. And he was amazed. He was like, what? You this is what you do? And I go, yeah. So I have this thing called the Dr. Vox. I think I was talking to you about that, Peter. It's a, where you blow bubbles like you're, ooh, but you're blowing into a water bottle. Basically, it's a glorified water bottle with a straw and you're making bubbles. And what it does is it vibrates on your cords and it loosens them up. There's been people that have actually, you know, Jamie Vendera, he's the one that turned me on to it. And he said there's been people that have had like polyps and that, and they've gotten rid of them using this. Now, like knock on wood, I've never had anything like that, nodes or polyps or anything like that. Thank God. But so I do this like warming up that Jamie actually turned me on to, this whole warming up. And then believe it or not, when I actually sing through a lot of the songs that are in the first set, but very light, not too light, but not full up, not full voice, but pretty light. And I kind of do that. And then I hit the stage. I take about 15, 20 minutes before hitting the stage. I get quiet, I walk around, maybe like doing stuff like that, maybe. And then I hit the stage and it's just, it's there, you know, unless I'm sick. And then I just hate life. Then I hate life, you know?
I tell you, you were, I want to get into a conversation about your tone.
I have this
thought process around vocal tone that it is very often in singers that we remember and that we gravitate to and that have these long careers.
Yeah.
There's something unique about their tone. And there's some of that that I think is a gift and some of it that has to be honed. I remember being you gave me some backstage passes or something. And I was there at a show in Seattle again, where you were, after the band had done their sound check, you came out, just you and the sound guy. You just did some vocal check and some vocal warm up. And you didn't know I was sitting out in the dark and sitting, you didn't know I was there, but I sat and listened to you dial in to what I think was intonation. And you found this resonance in vowels. And I don't know if they were vocal exercises or what, but it was remarkable how I watched you kind of without expending more energy, finding this place in the tone that just became so expansive inside the theater. And right. So I wanted to ask you, like, how much do you think about that and how much of that is instinctive?
I think initially I'm extremely focused on the sound that I want for any particular song. So initially I would be extremely focused on that, on the tone, on the placement and how it, even how it's like the embellishments or nuances that are within a melody. I'm very, very focused on that initially. And then it becomes almost instinctual, it becomes second nature. As you know, as I've established that palette, then I'm good to go. And then I know exactly where I'm going to have to go, where I'm going to go with the placement and the sound that I want to achieve. You know, like, for example, a good example of this, Peter, would have been when I was doing The Astonishing, and I had seven characters, and you know this intimately because you wrote the book on it, and, you know, and you did a superb job, by the way, and when I was coming to each one of those characters, I had to think of, first of all, who they are, what they're, you know, try to imagine or interpret what their personality, and the personality is what gives somebody, I think, their voice. And so when I was approaching any one of those characters, it was so funny because I was working with Rich Chickie at the time. And I said, Rich, this is how we're going to do it. So we're going to do, whoever it might be, like, let's do Nefarious, right? And let's do him. Let's kick him off. And once I establish his sound, then all I'm going to do when I come back to Nefarious, you're going to play me a snippet, just a little snippet of what I've created. And then we're going to do the next section. And then we're going to do, and that's what I did. And then I went on to the next character. And then I went on the next character. And it was, that's how I kind of built it. So that by the time we were done doing the album, I already knew before we were even touring the sound and the placement.
Oh, yeah. That mm-hmm. makes a lot of sense. As I was looking back over your career, it mm-hmm. was interesting to me. I knew some of these at the time, but when you start to look at them successively, you worked with Arjun on The Human Equation and you voiced the character there. Mm-hmm. You worked with Arian and played the character of the historian. Mm-hmm. You were in another, you played a role of an arrogant doctor in Baby Steps with Henning Pauly. So you
did Leonardo da Vinci. I did that as well.
That's right. So you have this mm-hmm. This pedigree of mm-hmm. being able to do characters inside concept albums. Did you evolve this kind of matured approach for characterization, or is that something that you kind of just naturally did right from the go when you were asked to do this kind of singing?
Yeah, I mean, I have to be completely. It's just kind of natural, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's something where once I'm presented with whatever that project might be or whatever it is that I'm going to be, having to tackle, it's just I immerse myself within whatever that is, and I sit with it. I keep reading over with the lyrics to my part, and then essentially become it. And then I find that if I can be, the more intimate I can be with that person so that it almost becomes you, yourself, then what comes out of you, it's natural and it's not forced, it's not contrived. And I think that's what makes the difference. I really do. I think the more comfortable you are with the character that you're going to play, vocally, then that just emotionally, it feeds through that spectrum to become your voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk just a little bit about how you built some of the formal education you did. You already mentioned Jamie Bandera, your original coach that I think you credit with a lot of pointing you in the right direction was Rosemary Burns.
Yep. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What is like one of the big, I guess, pieces of advice or training that helped establish you on this path that you learned from her?
Well, see, I went to her. I was holy shit, how old was I? 22 years old. I went to her, and I just went to her because I was curious. And what I had been told is a friend of mine knew this manager, and this manager had sent some of his band's singers to her. And I said, so what about it? Because like back then, Peter, I was able to sing songs like Barracuda from Heart. I was able to just get on stage and sing that and have a freaking great time with it. And, but what I found is I was in bar bands and I was going to all these sleazy bars and rooms, smoke-filled rooms, doing three sets a night, sleeping in bed-infested, bug-infested beds. Oh, it was horrible, but it was rock and roll. It was rock and roll when I was young. And but what I found is that it was very taxing. We had to do six nights a week, six nights in a row. And then the one day that we would have off on the Sunday was us driving to the next town so that we had our residence at that place for the next 6 days. And I found it very tiring. I'd be okay, but I just could feel that it was starting to wear on me. And so I went to see Rosemary and I was telling her about this, and she was listening to my voice and she goes, oh my God, like, first of all, you're singing up in the stratosphere. You know, that's part of the, you're setting yourself up. And I said, yeah, but it's very natural for me. I said, it's because I'm doing six nights in a row every week. Like this is, she goes, well, that's a big problem too. You shouldn't be doing that. So she started teaching me. She said, well, if you're going to do it, then we just got to, you know, you're not going to change, right? I said, well, I've got to do it at this point in my career. Maybe when I get into a band that actually records is with a label, we're on a tour, maybe it won't be so arduous. Little did I know I'd be getting into Dream Theater. But so she started teaching me this thing called the mask. And it was extremely invaluable, where you're pushing your notes, you know, through your clef and your cheeky nose, your passaggio, and just actually driving the notes to resonate through your bone structure in your face. And I just found, like she said, no, you got to do a lot of humming so that you can actually feel it. And then once you feel the humming and the buzz in those areas, excuse me, then you will be able to create those sounds even when you're singing full and you're very open. And that's what she taught me. And it was amazing, because at that point I was able to go out right after seeing her for only like, I think I only saw her for like 3 months, you know, and I'd see her once a week. And at one point she just said to me, I really don't know what else I'm going to show you at this point. You can keep coming here if you like me. I said, I love you. But she said, but you don't really need to. I'd rather you stay at home and just keep working on what we've been going through for the last few months. So I did that. And then years later, Peter, I started working with this girl called Victoria Thompson. And she was extremely well-trained as well. She had her schooling from the Music Conservatory down in St. Louis. And then she went to Europe and she performed operas for 20 years. And she happened to be in the neighborhood where I live. And she was amazing too. She's got this big, powerful voice, beautiful, beautiful voice. So I learned some things from her. Actually, I studied with her for a bit just before we went out on the Train of Thought tour. And I believe, did I not see you on the Train of Thought tour in Seattle?
Yeah, I think every tour you've come through my town, I've
been. Yeah. But anyway, so, you know, and she was of the same, like, you know, it was all about this warming up and cooling down and stuff like that. And then in the last few years, off and on, I've been working off and on with Jamie, because he has some very cool approaches as well as to being able to sustain oneself on a very lengthy and demanding tour. So he's all about endurance. He's all about reading not only your voice, but your body, your mindset, your emotional set, you know, because, you know, that's a big drain on a vocalist too, is the psychological aspects that can wreak havoc on a singer is when you have been ill and you're on tour and you know that you're not able to give it, that it kind of puts you in a very dark place, because you're trying to get better, but at the same time, you're having to go out there and exert yourself, which most normal human beings would not be doing. They would be laying down on a couch and trying to recover. So it's everything's working against you. So there's that. And I'm sure you can attest to this. There's that whole psychological aspect that singers have to really deal with. It can be demons or they can be your best friend, you know?
Well, you know, the touring environment strikes me as the absolute worst for the vocalist, because guys like you, you have people who want your time for press. You have meet and greets. I was going to just echo what you said about the mask. The singer that I trained with, who by the way trained Ann Wilson, that was the exact thing that he taught guys like Tate and Lane Staley too. Like he has and his main thing was exactly that mask. And I remember one of my early lessons with him, he said this, he says, speech is the enemy to the singer. So I then started to you know, connect the dots. I said, all right, so if you're out on tour and you want to be in a progressive metal band, that's going to be singing by definition, really, really athletic material. You're going to be asked all day to talk to press and radio. You're going to have sound check. You're going to have meet and greets. You're probably, the other thing was sleep. you don't get as much sleep as you'd want. So there's this like conflation of all the worst possible conditions for a singer.
Dry hotel rooms.
Dry hotel rooms. Not that necessarily the best diet because it's what you can get fast sometimes. I just started to think about this. And all of this stuff is what just for guys like you that do this at such a high level, sustaining over a period of time, it just kind of raised in my estimation what goes on. And it's part one of the things I wanted to be sure and talk about today, because I don't think, it's not that they need to, but I wanted to share and have an opportunity to share that. I think that this is really important for people to understand when they're looking at any band like Dream Theater that's trying to do it. And you've done it for so long at such a high level that it amazes me. It amazes me that you've just recorded your 15th studio album, countless, you know, and how much you guys tour. I want to commend you on it. I think it's remarkable.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's very nice to hear, man. Thank you. I appreciate that. And hey, you know, just to let you know, Peter, I have two more songs vocally to record for my next solo album. Now, I just want to make this really clear to everyone that's hearing this and seeing this great show, is that it's not a solo album with Matt Guillory. Matt Guillory, I love him. I think he's an incredibly talented man. But this time I wanted to go in a different direction. I wanted to really kind of do some of the stuff that I loved growing up. Was when I would hear Led Zeppelin do acoustic stuff. And so I based our starting point, and I'm working with this guy, Paul Logue, who has been in a band called Eden's Curse. And actually, Dream Theater, we brought them out with us in 2011, and we had them back us up in Europe for one leg of the tour. And I just like this stuff. It's more like the classic hard rock thing. And Paul and I had been talking about getting together and writing an album for the last decade. And we finally, pandemic comes in, and we're like, it was crazy. The last day of Dream Theater's tour in we had just done two nights in London where we recorded the Memories DVD that just came out. And our last show was in Glasgow. And I was in the airport the next day to fly home. I bump into Paul Logue. And he tells me he was at the show the night before. And the only reason he didn't get in touch with me, because he had the wrong email. So anyways, long story short, let's put together this album. And we put it together. It's based more on an acoustic approach, even though it has more of the heavier tones to it. But melodically, it's gorgeous. It's beautiful. You're going to appreciate where I went vocally on this album. And so I have Paul Logue, who's playing all the rhythm guitar. I have Marco Spoli doing all of the solos. I have my son Chance playing drums, and I have Christian Polankinen. Oh geez, I can't remember how to say his last name, but he's a great keyboard player. And so we put together all these songs, eight songs. But you know, I was basically saying it has to have the true essence of a classic acoustic album, but with more heaviness and more grit to it. So I already have a title for it. It's called A Beautiful Shade of Gray. And I named it that because lyrically, once I read through all the lyrics that I wrote, it's dealing in I know you can relate to this, Peter, because you're an amazing novelist too, and I've read your books and that. But it's the whole emotional human experience that we go through, right, in life. So we have the beautiful parts of life, the successes, the blissfulness and all that. And then we have the tragedy, the sadness and all that. So that's why I came up with this. But anyways, I'm rambling on here, but I'm really excited for everyone to hear this new album.
Well, I was going to ask you about it because there's a bunch of other things I want to cover, but while we're on it, let's just talk about that. You also got your son playing on this record.
Correct. Yeah.
And yes. And you said two more songs. Do we have a projected release, or is that too far away?
Yeah. I mean, if I was to guesstimate on it, I would say either late this year or early 2022. Yeah. Just because of like the whole setup. And then, you know, I got Dream Theater, that whole thing on the horizon with a release and all that, that's about to start materializing. And so, yeah, I would say safely late this year, maybe definitely early next year. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, so I want to go back in time again. So we've all, those of us who are hardcore fans have all heard the story. There were 200 vocalists who were kind of, I guess, in some way auditioning or up for the thing. Of course, you got the gig. I wondered, though, like in my mind, it conjures this like huge line. I suspect it was not that. Had they were they just like doing a lot of screening of tapes and then bringing in who seemed like that they would be a best fit? Because I mean, it's pretty remarkable that there were that many vocalists, and of course you're the guy that nod. So I'm wondering, was it like you were one of the few that they actually took care to bring to New York to hear live? And then was it like a day of jamming? How did that process go?
So I'll try and do the synopsis of how it all unfolded here. So basically I was in a band called Winter Rose. We were out touring with a band called Lee Aaron, and she was referred to as the metal queen in Canada. And what happened was she came up to me while we were out. We were just doing a little Canadian tour with her, and she came up to me and she said, "Hey, do you have we're going back here, by the way, everyone. This was like 1990. Hey, do you have a CD of your stuff?" And then I said, "Yeah, absolutely. You know, here you go." And because she said, "I really love what I'm hearing here." And so I give her a CD. I go, "Yeah, check this out. This is all original." And she comes back and she goes, "Holy shit." She goes, "This stuff's amazing." And she said, "Have you ever like thought about a solo career?" And I go, "No, this is my band. Like, I'm in this band with Rich Chickie. This is our band. We are the band. We write this stuff, we record it and all this stuff. And we're being looked at by Atlantic, and we're being looked at by some other labels out there getting signed." And she was like, "Oh, well, okay. Well, do you mind if I hang on? I'll make sure nobody gets this." Unbeknownst to me, she throws it to this guy who, Pierre Paradis in Montreal. And he was one of the head A&R guys with Aquarius Records. Out of the blue, I get this phone call one day. I'm living down in Toronto at the time. And he says, "Hey, how you doing, James? This is Pierre Paradis. And I'm with Aquarius Records. And I'd love to offer you a solo album deal. And then I'd like you to write the entire album with Alda Nova. Do you remember Alda Nova?"
I do, yeah.
Yeah, he had a song, "Life is Just a Fantasy."
That's right.
"Can you live this fantasy life?" Yeah. So I was like, yeah, you know, that's great, but no, I'm not interested. I got Winter Rose here, and I'm going to stick to it because we're being looked at by some major labels. I really appreciate this. It's not a solo album. So he took the CD and he throws it down to MCA, the label down in New York, to this girl Charity, who was one of the head persons down there. And he said, "Hey, you know, you were mentioning to me there's this band down there called Dream Theater, and they're pretty much set on a singer, and they were working with this guy Steve Stone for the last 8 months, and they had recorded a bunch of stuff, but you know, they're not quite sure. They're pretty sure, but they're not sure." And Charity, and he told Charity, he goes, "Get this to them and let's see what they think about, because I think this is their guy." So what happened was, what was told to me by Mike and John and Kevin Moore, was that they got in, they were at rehearsal one night. Mike had the CD. They got into Mike's van and they put the CD in and they cranked it up. And it was a live recording that I had done with Winter Rose at Rock and Roll Heaven down in Toronto, which was a really popular rock bar down there. It was like everybody and their mother played there. And it was just, it was like jam packed every night. And so they listened to him. They're like, "What the hell's going on here?" So they got in touch with me. They brought me down. I jammed with them. Like they flew me down. I stayed at Mike's place for a couple of days. Then I stayed at John Myung's place for a couple of days. But the very first day I got there, I jammed with them a whole night, and we just went through a lot of the songs were from When Dreamin' Day Unite that I sang. And then we did Love and Touch and Squeeze Them by Journey. Nice. And then, so right after the rehearsal, they brought me to this diner and they talked to me and they're like, "Hey man, you know, oh my God, that's freaking amazing. Holy shit." And I said, "Yeah, I loved it." And because, you know, I was also trying to see how I felt with these guys, you know, is it going to be, is there a chemistry here? And definitely there was. So the next day they said, "Hey, do you mind, like, if, can we start recording a little demo?" And we did, we started, I think we did Learning to Live, A Change of Seasons, Take the Time, I think. And I don't know if we did Pull Me Under, something like that. Or it might've been Metropolis or something. And so, cause I was only there for 5 days. So we recorded all this stuff at John Mayung, had a roommate, he had a condo. And then in his bedroom, he had this little, I think it was an 8-track recorder, and we recorded all those songs. And then I said, "Okay, guys, see you later." And the last day, or the second last day, they asked, they said, "Okay, we're set on this. We want you to be in the band. Will you be the singer for the band?" And I said, "Absolutely. I think you guys are awesome." I said, "I think this, we really got something going on here." And then the rest is history. It just went from there. Yeah.
Oh, I'm glad you told that story. There's a bunch of that I've never heard before.
Yeah.
That's good. That's really, really good stuff. Mm-hmm. Let's transition a little bit and talk about some of the collaborative stuff. I have to tell you, this goes way back with the first, it might've even been the first thing I heard you sing ever. It's so long, I can't remember, but it was actually the backing vocals to a Fates Warning track called
Life. Oh yeah. Life in Still Water. Yeah.
As soon as I heard the back, I mean, I knew it wasn't Ray, who I also love, but I heard that. I was like, who the hell is that?
Yeah.
It was. Yeah. I mean, it was.
Go ahead. No, that was amazing. Cause I remember Mike calling me, Mike Portnoy, and he was like, "Hey, you know, James, or, you know, the friends of ours, Fates Warning." And I said, "Oh yeah, like I've heard of Fates Warning. I know what you're talking about. I haven't really delved into them, but I know the band." And he goes, "Well, you know, like, they're up in Toronto right now, but their singer, he's already gone back home, and they got this song where they want to lay down these background vocals. And they were wondering if you come in." And Terry Brown, who's, you know, he's renowned for all his work that he did with Rush, he's mixing it and he's going to be there. I think I more or less jumped for the opportunity just to meet Terry Brown. You know, I was like, "What? Terry Brown? Are you freaking kidding me? No, I got to go meet Terry Brown." And, and it was funny because he says, "Okay, so what's going to happen is you're just going to come in and then we'll, are you okay if we just start playing you the song then and we just show you the parts then and you can do it? Or do you want us to send you a tape and you can sit with it for a couple of days?" I said, "No, man, let's just go for it. How about I just come in, you show me the parts that I'm going to sing and we'll do it." And he goes, that's great. So I got there, met Terry, and Jim was there as well. Mateos. And then we just, you know, they said, "Okay, this is what we want. This is what we're thinking about you singing." I said, "Okay, great. Let's get in there. Let's go for it." And it was just a really fun time. I think I was only there like an hour and a half. And then I just sat around with them for a bit, shot the guff, and, "Hey guys, this has been a slice. Thanks a lot." And they were like, "Oh, thank you so much for coming in." And that was it. Yeah.
Oh, it came out great, man. And by the way, you mentioned Rush. I have to tell you, one of the collaborative things you did do is you were on a Rush tribute. And you've done others. You've done Queen and others. Mm-hmm. Rush, you did Red Barchetta.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I have to tell you, it's my favorite rendition of Red Barchetta.
Thank you, man. Jeez. I had a great time doing that. I actually recorded that with Rich as well, Rich Chickie. My longtime friend. Yeah. Pardon me?
Are you the guy that brought Rich kind of into the dream? Because he worked with you guys on the production side. Was that because?
Yeah. So Rich was kind of like, even, you know, I mean, obviously when I left Winter Rose, it was kind of like a bittersweet thing, right? You know, And but Rich and I, we stayed in touch, and Rich went on to, you know, engineer and work with like Aerosmith and Seal and Mick Jagger, and the list goes on and on and on. And he was really making a mark in that part of the industry. And, you know, he'd keep coming to our shows. And so the guys got to know him, all the guys in Dream Theater got to know him. And it just came around when we were going in to do a dramatic turn of events. And I was like, guys, you know, this is our opportunity. Let's get Rich in to engineer this album. And then eventually he went on to, you know, engineer and mix the self-titled and Astonishing. But yeah, it was basically, you know, it was just because him and I had stayed in touch, and he got to know the guys in the band very well. And then, and it was just, it was perfect timing for him to come in when he did at Dramatic, with Dramatic. Yeah.
Yeah. He also did work with Rush. I picked up this quote.
Oh yeah.
Said, I have never enjoyed the recording process so much, nor been so satisfied with the results.
Yeah. He's brilliant. I mean, yeah, Rich is brilliant. He's a brilliant man. He's a great engineer. You know, he really is. And he is one of the funniest guys you will ever meet in your life. Like, I mean, he can do imitations of anyone. It's really crazy. How he can tap into someone's sound and their whole way about them. I'm lost for words right now, but you know, it's uncanny how he can do that. And he just has everyone in stitches, because you're looking at it and you're going, yeah, that's me. Yeah, that's me. And it's so funny, you know, but he's a great guy. Great guy.
Cool how he's kind of stayed in and out of your life over the years.
Yeah, for sure.
I want to talk about your solo work. So I love it all, and I want to talk about more than just the one, but the very first record is, there's a song on that called As a Man Thinks. Mm. It starts out with this really cool, almost like rock and roll rap thing, where you're it's just you singing, but it's like you're going at it and you're telling this story. And then then some instrumentation comes in, and there's a breakdown section that is just beautiful. I've never forgotten the melody or words for this. And it's actually where I ended up with the name for this show, Breaking Absolutes, because you've got a line in there where you you say, my life's a requiem playing out of key with no absolutes at all. And I got thinking about absolutes because I know that this is a reference to music.
Right,
all the connotations that language and that sound has stayed with me forever. And you know, I don't know how many people remember that record or go back to it, but it is so innovative, I think.
Thank you for all that, Peter. That's the late great, you know, Trent Gardner. He was a brilliant musician, and he heard that I was going in to do a solo album. And I, you know, primarily it was, all the songs were written by Matt Guillory and myself, but there was, you know, here comes Trent, and he's like, oh, you know, James, I've been a huge fan for a very long time. And what do you think about maybe doing this song? And he played me this song, and I was like, oh my God, this song is brilliant, Trent. And I said, man, that's a challenge. And I love that. I love that, because, you know, like, we're only as good as, you know, what we put before us, and we have to keep building and evolving, you know, as human beings. And when I heard that song, like, he just gave me a rough demo, and I was just like, oh, no, there's no two ways about it. I'm doing that. Let's do it. Let's do this song. And I had such a great time. He was such a lovely person. I mean, I really miss him. He was just a great spirit, Trent, and an amazing, like, well, we did Leonardo, right? The Absolute Man. Sure. And that stemmed from us working together, you know, and doing, you know, I did a few songs of his on my solo stuff. And, you know, he was like, I've been asked to do this, and I got to write this whole opera, rock opera based on Leonardo. And he says, I, you know, without question, I want you to be Leonardo. I want you to be the lead role. And I was like, you know what? Just tell me when, where, and I'll be there, you know? And, but yeah, that's great that you picked up on that, because that is a terrific song. It's a terrific song. Yeah.
It's not the track too. The Shores of Avalon is a
song. Oh yeah.
Kind of a Zeppelin.
Yeah.
It's just a great album. And mm-hmm. and then there are several more for me, as I was even re-listening to them in preparation for us to have this chat.
Yes.
Yeah. You got to Static Impulse and Impermanent Resonance. Mm-hmm. There, it felt to me like there was a change. The song became, the music to me became a little bit heavier. Mm-hmm. I mean, not just because of the introduction of the sort of very aggressive vocals, which was I want to ask you about. But was there, mm-hmm. Was that just a natural evolution, or did you and the others kind of think about, hey, well, let's just kind of take this to another place with your solo?
Yeah. So Matt and I, we were, you know, after doing Elements of Persuasion in 2004, that's when we brought in Marco Sfoli too, which was, he's just a phenomenal talent and, you know, incredible guitar player. But when we were coming up and we were starting to write songs for Static Impulse, it was kind of like Matt and I were just leaning more towards being inspired by heavier music. But, you know, as much as we wanted the music to be a little more aggressive, you know, the one thing that we completely 100% agreed upon was that the melodies had to be amazing. And yes, it was the first album where we introduced the, you know, the guttural vocals, and some people call them Cookie Monster vocals, but it was at that point that we wanted to bring in, and I looked at it more like a tool, more a tool more than an instrument, you know. And Peter Wildeur, the drummer, is the one that was doing all the grunt vocals, and he does a phenomenal job. I mean, if you're going to do it, you got to do it right. It's got to be authentic. It's got to be believable, you know. And and I think he does an incredible job when he does those type vocals. But I remember saying to Matt, I said, you know, like this is something that's cool, and it'll be unexpected, and it can very well work, but it's how we're going to use it within the arrangements, how we're going to use it within the structuring of the music. It has to make sense. If it's not going to make sense and it's going to feel forced, there's no freaking way that this is going to be on the album. And he was, you know, Matt was completely in agreement, and he's the kind of guy too, when you tell him something, he knows, you know, he's such an amazing musician that he knows how to go about things that the realization will be fully felt. And so it was just more or less, I just said, let's just keep this in mind. This is a tool. This is another element. This isn't really to be looked at like additional vocals, because it's not. To me, it's not. It's not, I don't care how you want to slice and dice it. It's not singing. That's an emotion. That to me is, what's the word I'm looking for? Like where it's the true essence of our ancestry. You probably know the word I'm talking about, but the babble, right? Yeah. Right. And but to me, I think it's very effective. And the way that we integrated it within the songs, within Static Impulse and Impermanent Resonance, whereas Impermanent Resonance, it was a little bit more minimal. It was a little bit more dialed back a bit, because the melodies were so gorgeous on that album. And there was so much for me to play with as a vocalist on that album, especially Impermanent Resonance. And, you know, to me, I said to Matt, I said, you know what, we just reached another level as far as I'm concerned. When we did Impermanent Resonance, to me, that's just that we just up the game for sure.
You did. Those two records are, any Dream Theater fan who hasn't heard them needs to hear them. Not because mm-hmm. they're the same, but because there's enough reference points that
yeah.
they deserve, I think, a broader audience. They're just amazing. And I have to tell you, this morning I put on In Permanent Resonance and I was listening through and I got to Say You're Still Mine.
Oh yeah.
That got me in the feels, man. I got some chills listening to that song.
That's great.
There's times I think it's when, where you are in your life and, but you tapped into some emotion, relationship emotion there. That's really powerful.
Yeah. You know, thank you. And I think some of the other songs where I thought really lent themselves to a vocalist were songs like Holding On and Amnesia, like those songs, you know, or Back on the Ground. Like they're all like very, very vocal oriented. And it's either you hit the mark or you don't. And if you, the song, it would completely collapse if the vocals didn't truly represent what the melody is trying to convey, you know? Yeah. And I remember just going into the studio and starting to sing those songs and being so freaking ramped up because I just knew that, you know, these songs were going to be so powerful when they were done and concluded. And then having Jens Bogren mix them. I mean, the guy's just freaking a powerhouse on his own, you know, and he's such an incredible mixer. But yeah, we just had so much fun with that. You know, and you know, like let's face it, like Ray Riendo, the bass player, phenomenal bass player, and you know, because I always refer to it's my other band because I've been with these guys now for quite some time, and you got Marcos Foley on guitar, and you got Peter Wildewer on drums, a phenomenal drummer, and then you got Matt Guillory, you know, like keyboard player extraordinaire and a fantastic composer, and you know, and that's why writing with him and putting this stuff together, it's so effortless, you know, like it just seems to, and we noticed that when we first started working together in the first Mall Muzzler album, is that it was just something that it just, we got along immediately. We understood one another. He was a huge Dream Theater fan. He goes, I remember the first time I saw you, man. I was just like, I think he was only like 19 or something like that. And he says, I went and saw you in San Francisco on your Awake tour, the Awake tour. And I was like, oh my God, yeah, that's a while ago. But yeah, it's just, I'm very proud of the stuff that Matt and I put together with those albums for sure.
It's phenomenal work. Anybody who hears this live or later, if you've not heard these records, you're in for a treat. Go look them up.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's use that as a transition to talk about Dream Theater a little bit. So here's stories I don't think I ever told you. Right. So when that Images and Words album dropped, I was in a progressive metal band in Salt Lake City, Utah. Later you guys toured there. I have a fun little story where, and I know you did this with a lot of shows, but I was right in front of you. You threw the mic down and you let me sing a song, a line from Take the Time. I was over the moon, right? That you know, you were that interactive with the crowd. But the day that the album dropped, me and all the guys in the band went, we picked it up. I was driving a black Jeep at the time, put it in after work. We just drove around listening to it. And I had this really interesting reaction. It was really love-hate. I loved it because it was everything I wanted to do. I hated it because I was like, well, I should give up. Like, they've already done all this. I can't be that. And I was just like, so I had this little bit of animosity for you because you were so damn good.
My intention.
No, that was silly human. Yeah, and I got over it very quickly. Yeah. It was like, you know, it's like you all of a sudden see the fruition of everything you're dreaming and striving towards vocalist.
Yeah.
And I got over myself and I ended up going and doing some training and moving on. But you know, that was a defining moment. And I'm not the only one who has stories around your entrance into the group, because as good as the group is at every position and in all the songwriting, it's just kind of undeniable that your voice put a signature to it that didn't exist before. Right. And you guys, I think still today, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, the biggest sort of radio hit, if you want to call it that you've had was Pull Me Under. Got the most recognition and all of that. Mm-hmm. And at the time, it was in an era of you know, rock and metal vocal music where hitting the big notes with strength and power and getting up in the range was kind of a hallmark. There were other guys doing it. All of a sudden, here comes James LaBrie with this. And in at the end of that chorus, you just do this. You hit this note with such strength and tone and power that it, it kind of gave people chills. Like, and I'm not, this isn't hyperbole. This is what happened. And it's part of how people started in our community talking about it. Have you heard Promo Yonder? Oh my God, what did the singer do? Yeah. So like you're very much responsible as much as everybody in the group for putting Dream Theater on the map. I wanted to be sure and say that as it's, you know, and then we've talked about how you've you know, persisted over time with the strength of the material.
Right. But
then you did this really interesting thing. And when Awake came out, I was, I got it bootleg.
Oh, I know where you're going to go. Where you're going.
You know, and I heard this bootleg cassette and I thought, okay, that's, and my friend didn't tell me who it was. And I couldn't tell.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell. And then when he told me, I thought, okay, well, that's tape degradation or something. You know, I'm not hearing it right. And then when I got the record and I heard
degradation. I love that. Oh my God. Okay, go ahead.
When I finally heard the album,
yeah,
and I heard you taking this new approach,
yeah,
I was floored. I was floored in a good way because it was like he's taken all of the power and all of the range, and now he's introduced this. You know, some people call it rasp or gruff or, you know, there's lots of names, this extra layer. And I was like, where the hell did this come from? And by the way, it's not a technique I could do. So I was envious.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that I think is unique. There's one of my favorite Broadway musicals is called Jekyll and Hyde. And there's a vocalist that did this, the original cast by the name of Robert Kukuli, I think is his name.
Right.
But he did the same thing in playing those two characters, where he's really clean and more Broadway-esque, and then he gets really dirty and gruff
to play
the Jekyll character. Mm-hmm. And I just got thinking, how did you... So the question is, that's a long preamble to, how did you decide, I'm going to just go at this different with this record, and which has become a fan favorite?
Yeah. You know, I think it was kind of... leading that way, was going that way. Like if you go back to some of the shows live in Images and Words, and you can find various live shows of me singing, I actually brought, and you can attest to this because you did see me on the images, as much as I kept it clean 90 to 95% of the night, the singing, I was starting to really introduce this other side of me that nobody really knew. And that was to sing rasp. And I could do it anytime. I could turn it on, turn it off, turn it on, turn it off. So when it came time that the Awake material was being written, and I'm in there and I'm demoing, you know, and I'm singing the demos, and, you know, whether it was for a song like Lie, Don't Tell Me. And I was doing stuff like that. And I remember hitting it. Actually, Kevin Moore, our first keyboard player, he was recording me that night. He came in. I said, okay, you know, because back then it was like these little recording boards that you had, and we'd do it right in our rehearsal studio. And he was sitting there and he was hearing me, and I was just like turning on the rasp and then playing along with it. And I was making it clean and I was making it raspy. And he's like, holy shit. He says, James, man, that's really cool. You got to do that. I said, well, I'm actually thinking about incorporating that a lot of the album. And he goes, man, freaking go for it. He goes, like, especially with these songs, it just really lends itself. It accentuates the aggression. And I said, perfect. You know, so that's what I started doing, especially with songs like The Mirror, you know, and even in like Caught in a Web and stuff like that, where I would make it clean on the choruses and then, you know, grit it during the verses or whatever. And I was doing that. And then, but at the same time, I wanted to also let people know, no, I'm still here and I still want to be known as a clean singer. So, you know, when we were doing songs like Innocence Faded or anything like that, you know, I was just keeping it completely, even though Like there were a couple moments in that song too, where I did just a little slight hint of a rasp, you know, but it was just something that I, you know, I'd always been able to do. And I just wanted to introduce it. And the Awake album was my, you know, perfect opportunity.
Yeah. It's an amazing album with how you, I just added this additional technique. And I know that you're quoted someplace as saying that you're, one of your favorite songs to sing live is Scarred.
Oh my God. Yeah.
That is a favorite of mine. My small story there, which some folks who've watched this stream may have heard, but all these years later, that song it hit me like squarely in my personal life in a very, very powerful and cathartic way.
Okay.
So much so that I was able to obtain a stem, and I've been singing it for cathartic reasons.
Wow.
Yeah. It's I tell you that mostly because I want you to understand that, and I'm not the only fan of yours that feels this way. Your music touches people.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there's the rock and the metal, and you get to rock out and just release the energy and stuff. But there's definitely a part of this with songs that mean something to people. And that one, and the way you sing that song, just so filled with the emotion. And it couldn't have possibly been life experience at that point because you were too young, but you somehow tapped into it. I wanted to share that with you. When I record my version of it, I'll send it to you and you can critique.
Yeah, you should. You should. I'm sure you nail it. You got a great voice, man. So I'm sure you nail it. But, you know, like that whole thing, that whole experience, and we just come off like a big album with Images and Words, and we were recording it down in LA, you know, and living down there. And I as much as I try and remember, I can't remember the actual song I was singing, but I got a good story for you. When I was in session one day doing vocals for one of the songs from the Awake album, it was so funny because I'm out in the room and I'm in front of the microphone and I'm singing. I think actually it might've been Innocence Faded, but I don't know. I can't recall distinctly, but which one it was, but, and I remember we had the producers, Dwayne Barron and John Purdell at the time. They were producing us, and they made their big name by producing No More Tears by Ozzy's album.
Oh yeah.
And so I'd be out in the room and I was singing, and you know, I'm looking at them. I got the cans on my head, you know, the headphones, and the music's cranking them. You know, I'm just going nuts. And all of a sudden I'm looking at them and they're just going, and they got this look on their face like, oh shit. And I just went, and I stopped, and I'm like, what the fuck? What are you guys doing? And all of a sudden I'm here. And there was a freaking earthquake. And I see these two guys and they're bolting out of the studio. And I'm like, wait for me. And it was so funny. I'll throw the cans down and I'm running outside and they're like, holy shit, man, we're having an earthquake. And it was just crazy. It was so bizarre. And then they're like, okay, well, we got to wait a bit. You know, we got to make sure the structure's fine. And then there we are 2 hours later, we're back in. And we're you know, continuing with the recording, but just the way that all went down, because I had the music and the music was just cranking. So initially I didn't even clue in to these vibrations coming up through my legs and feet and everything else, because it was just, I was so like enraptured with the music. And it wasn't until I saw their faces like, oh my God, you know, and I'm like, what the hell is going on here? Yeah. So, it was funny.
So yeah. Funny.
Yeah.
So you know, the first time that we like met was the Falling Into Infinity tour. I think I saw you on all the other tours, and we did meet and we would talk. But I think when we actually kind of knew who we were looking at was was at a theater called the Phoenix that has since closed in Seattle. And I saw backstage pass, and they had the underground green room, and I got to come down, and you and I got chatting, and. You like all the rest of the guys, we'd been talking so long, they're like, we're going back to the hotel. You stuck on with me for like another 20 or 30 minutes. And you know, I was this fledgling vocalist, and it meant so much to me that you spent so much time talking to me. It was, it was a testament to, you know, not just this guy who knows how to sing and has this career, but really cared about the fans. And the moment that was really poignant to me at that show was you played "Take Away My Pain." His dad. And you know, as can happen, the crowd was really raucous. And as you were kind of introducing it, it was just, you know, there was just voices and catcalls and all this stuff. And you took this moment to kind of quiet the audience, to sort of set the tone for this song you're about to sing, explain why. And it was just this really cool moment where everybody kind of just locked into, oh, okay, let's get the context on this song and appreciate what it is. And I wanted to applaud you as a vocalist for, like, you know, kind of taking command of the of the room. It clearly meant something to the group.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny because and I do recall that, because I find there's moments in the night, and I'm very sensitive to it, and I know the other guys in the band are too. It's like we're always wanting. You know, it's one thing to be there and to be thrilled with the environment, you know, and, you know, if we're playing a song and it's this bombastic song, yeah, then, you know, by all means, go crazy and scream your head off and jump up and try and touch the ceiling. You know, I'm all for that. But, you know, I've always been a firm believer that when, you know, you're doing more of the intimate songs or more the somber moments of the night, that I think that everyone should really be on the same page. And I find that there's some nights that the room just isn't, they're not together, they're not unified. And so there's many nights on tour that I, you know, if I sense that's happening or that discord is there, that I just kind of like, I really like to set the tone. And I find that by doing that, not only does it make us that much more intense as a band when we're playing that particular piece, but I find that the audience benefits from that as well, because I find that they now have sunk into that song exactly as it was intended. And that, to me, that's all part of the ride. That's all what really, really matters throughout the night. It's this dynamic ride. It's this roller coaster. And if you're not going to be made aware of it, then you're walking away and you haven't had the full experience. So to me, that really does matter.
Yeah, it does. And you do a really good job. It isn't the only time where you've, you know, really kind of given this help give this context and set the tone for these songs. And I think they land in a different, more impactful way when you do that. I wanted to ask you, you had the opportunity to play at the Marquee before it closed, right? For a live thing, that is one of the most historic, if not the most historic venue in all of London. What was that like?
Oh, man. Well, we're going back a little ways there, Peter. Yeah. But, holy smokes. That was 1993. It was amazing. You know, it's funny because you hear about this room and you hear about, like, everyone and their mothers played there, Rolling Stones, you know, and you get there and it's bigger, you know, it's you're thinking it's bigger than life. And it is, because of its reputation. Then you get there and it's this room. It's a moderate sized room. And, you know, it had this like top area, like a little balcony area, and it was beautiful, but it was more or less you're walking through like the vibe that I got, I was like, holy shit, like you know, like everybody was building it up so much that when I got there, it was a bit of a, what, well, this is the Marquee, okay, all right, well, whatever. You know, and we had a great time, and it was an amazing night, you know, playing there in the audience. It was just jam packed. And this was when everything was really going crazy for the band. And so to me, being able to play that, like even us doing like the Ronnie Scott's, you know, club, yeah, the jazz club. Yeah. You know, like, I mean, that was so cool. That was just like all of a sudden, you know, like you're in this little jazz club and you're playing and the people are like, you know, I'm singing and I could basically reach out and grab that guy's beer and start chugging it back if I wanted to. And it was a completely different experience, but it was at the same time, it was cool. It was novel to us because we hadn't played in that kind of an environment for so long. And so, yeah, but the Marquee, I mean, for all intents and purposes, it was an amazing night, and it did live up to its reputation in the sense that, you know, we were jazz going on stage. We were amped up. We knew that this was a iconic room. The audience was jacked up, and we put on a great show that night, just because of all those things lending themselves to the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I know I'm digging back, but the reason I bring those up is I'm in my other life as a fiction writer. I'm working on a big new collaboration with a best-selling fantasy writer by the name of Brandon Sanderson. When we're setting it in London, and the lead mm-hmm. character is a metal singer. So I've been doing all of this research about the music scene over there, and these names are popping up. And it's funny because that life's intersecting with my love of Dream Theater in all of these interesting touch points. Have these places.
Wow.
That's one of the reasons I'm digging back on it. But so let's fast forward, because I don't want to keep you all day. I had a bunch more questions, but I want to just dive into just a few more. I know that you can't say a lot about the new Dream Theater record because you guys do an artful job of disclosing and revealing, you know, tidbits as you get the run up. But I want to set the stage with this quote that we've got from Mangini about you. He said, James LaBrie is doing vocals now. So this is how many weeks ago. And I was listening to some of that he has put together, kind of the final rough mix. It's not mixed, but it's just a rough mix, if you will. And I was like, holy shit, people are going to freak out. I can't wait to share this album. So I know you had this period where that you were working through some things with your voice. And I honestly, James, every time I saw you live and certainly on the sound recordings, that was never in evidence. So I think you tackled that admirably. But
well, thank you.
Last several albums, so strong vocally. And so I'm just wondering what you can share with us, even if it's just like enthusiasm, about what you guys have just kind of started to put in the can for the new one.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna have to thank Mike for that. But put it this way, wow's a good description of this album. Mike nailed it. Wow, you know, I because when the songs were done, and then we were constructing the melodies, and John and I got together, and it was really cool. And I'm the kind of lyricist that I like my melodies written before I start doing my lyrics, because I just find that also lends itself to the emotion, and then the emotion kind of lends itself to the subject matter. And but going in to sing this album and just the music itself, I'm so limited to what I can say. Yeah, so it's like I got my hands tied here. But what I can say is that when everybody says this, you know, did you ever notice that every band, when they talk about their new album, they go, oh my God, this is the most incredible stuff that we've done. You know, I'm starting to sound like Jerry Seinfeld there, but and it's true. I guess, you know, because the band's excited and every band wants to really, set up their new album with and get people amped up. But with this album, all I can say is that when we were the music as a whole, and now with the vocals on top of it, I don't know. I'll just leave it at this. I said to John when I was finishing my last vocal, I said, you know what? We just upped the ante. I said, we just hit a whole new level. And I said, this is our 15th freaking album. And we've done it again. We've upped the ante. Like there's something going on here that I think the fans are just going to flip out. when they hear it. And he goes, I was totally saying, I said that to my wife the other night. I was sitting down, I was listening to the album from front to back, and I was freaking out. And I go, same here. Like, I'm listening to these songs when we're done them, I'm going back to the hotel room and I'm listening to them and I'm going, holy shit, what the hell's going on here? You know? And I think it's very exciting. And even Jordan, like, he was, you know, FaceTiming me and going, holy Jesus, you know, like, he's all amped up. He's like, holy shit, you know, is it just me or what are you hearing this stuff? I'm going, no, man, like, there's something really cool going on here. And he's going, the fans are going to freak out. I go, yeah, they are. They really are. So, you know, now all that being said, I can't really delve any, and I'm sorry for being so ambiguous, but
I get it.
That's about as accurate as I can get. I will say this, you know, like, in a few weeks, I take off and I'm going down. We're doing the big photo shoot and we're shooting the first video for the first single, or what we consider a single. What the hell's a Dream Theater single? What is that? I don't know. What the hell's a single anymore?
Yeah.
What the hell is a single? Right. So, I'm going down and we're shooting the video for that. And it's, you know, so we're all pretty, pretty excited about this. So, you know, the ball's starting to roll. The label's really, really psyched. You know, they can't wait, to get, you know, to get this into high gear. And, as far as the release, I can't, I'm going to say, let's just say fall sometime. I'm going to just say fall. And I think that would be pretty accurate for the release.
Yeah. Yep. And it looks like, obviously it can change, but it looks like touring, is going to be kind of back in swing later this year. I know that there's already some bands are planning even for festivals late summer. So fingers crossed. You know, we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, our camp, what we're being told, and I hope they're wrong. I mean, you know, but we were thinking, oh, maybe we can be out there maybe in November, December, you know, just start getting it, you know, a tour going. And then now we're talking, the latest that I've heard, but don't quote me on any of this, is the new year, you know, January, February, we'll be getting out there and we'll be starting to really hit the road and getting things back to normal. I think it's a matter of, you know, how fast are the inoculations going to happen worldwide? And, you know, you're still hearing about areas that are just going through a wretched period right now. And so I don't know. I hope that, you know, I'm going to be more optimistic, and I'm hoping that by October, November, that the world will be back to a certain level of normalcy. A sense of normalcy will ensue, right?
Yeah. I think we're all ready for as great as these sort of streaming things are, and I appreciate doing them and the chance to see them. There's no substitute for live.
No, there isn't. It's still it's like you're saying, you know, the streaming's great, but there's still that disconnect as far as I'm concerned. Yeah,
there's something ineffable about in-person connection, right? At a live show. Right.
Absolutely.
Especially for Dream Theater. It's anyway, so we'll all look forward to that.
Definitely. So are we.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you guys have always been such a great live group and tour so extensively.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's good you got side projects, I guess, to keep you busy during COVID.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, it's kept my sanity, that's for sure. Yeah.
Has your COVID music been principally other than the Dream Theater record, the solo effort, or have you been asked to do any other collaborations that might be coming up?
Yeah, I mean, I've sung some other stuff on there. Like, they're kind of keeping it tight wrap right now, but yeah, I mean, I just sang Have a Cigar for this label, Cleopatra. They asked me to sing the song Have a Cigar, and then they had me sing Pigs 3 from the Animal album. And it was really cool because they had Al DiMeola on guitar, Rick Wakeman on keys, Billy Cobham on drums, and Patrick Mraz. Well, Rick Wakeman did Have a Cigar. Patrick Mraz was key for Pigs 3. And I've had fun doing that because the other thing that happened was my son Chance and I, we built a studio in the basement. And that's great because that's where I've been singing a lot of my stuff. I didn't do the Dream Theater stuff here because John and I wanted to be together in the same room when I was singing. And we haven't done that. We figured that the last time that I actually sang in the studio with John was Black Clouds. That's the last time. Everything else I've done with Rich since then. Yeah. So it was kind of cool because we had a blast. It was a lot of fun. It was Jimmy T, James Meslin, who's our engineer now. It was him and it was Matty Schreiferstein, who's our right-hand man and our production assistant with everything. And is also John Petrucci's guitar tech when we're on tour. So he's a big part of our corporation. So it was just the four of us because we were like quarantining, you know, making sure that we could do this without bringing any harm to one another. And so it was really cool, like to build the studio in the basement here. And it's just enabled me, and I'm doing my whole solo album here. And it's great. You know, it's a lot of fun. And you know, just be able to walk downstairs and go, okay, you know, and Chance is recording all my vocals. He's basically being the engineer for that, you know, recording it. And it's great because he knows my voice so intimately. He's like, no, come on, Dad, you know, like I want to hear this part of you. And, you know, yeah, that sounds great what you did, but like I was expecting you to go here. And and he's being very brutally honest with me, like which is cool because the end result is like, hey, you know, Chance, that's really cool that you suggested that. And as much as I wanted to go into that area, and I thought it was a good move, when I A-B the two, your suggestion made sense. So it's cool. And we're having a lot of fun. We, you know, one thing he keeps saying to me off and on, he goes like, you know what, Dad, this is very surreal. Like I'm recording with you. And I go, well, hey, you think it's surreal to you? It's mind boggling to me. Like, you know, like you're sitting there with, you know, he's 23 years old now. He's got his own band, Falsett. And that's right. They're doing amazing. They're doing freaking amazing. If you get a chance, Peter, check them out. Falsett,
Falsett. The whole record.
God.
So good.
They're freaking great. And their new material is amazing. And no, these guys definitely have a future. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, they're all great players. And Zach is a great singer. Their singer, great voice. You know, he's just got a really great sound. And anyways, yeah. So hopefully, I guess your writing and your music has kept you sane throughout the pandemic.
Yeah, that's right. And the one plug I would make is I convinced you to sing a track on the record I wrote.
Absolutely.
They're called from my group Symphony North. And I wanted to tell you, I don't know if I told you this, but when I sang the original demo, but I didn't
want
the guy who was doing it on the final. Because I wanted to have voices in some of these characters. And when I started to think about, because I know the sort of landscape of male vocalists in rock and metal pretty well.
Yeah.
When I started thinking about who do I know that's got a voice who can do these very sort of important, intimate, like bare soul verses. But then later when it needs to hit a high C, go and do that, do it with authority. Yeah. And that list of vocalists is very small.
Mm-hmm.
The good fortune of mine is I know you, but I reached out and I told you the story of this thing and you're like, and you said yes, which floored me. And so even if you people don't listen to my whole record, go listen.
Oh, you have to listen to it. Yeah. It's an amazing record. And I just need to let the people know out there. Honest to God, I'm not just saying this because Peter, you're a great friend of mine. I love you. But the thing is that you have an amazing voice. And when you sent that demo, I remember playing it for Chance. I was like, listen to this guy. And he goes, hey, nothing for nothing, Dad, but I guess he just wants you because of your name. And I go, wouldn't you think?
No,
you know, because you did a freaking amazing job. Like it just sounds great. It sounds amazing. And I'm just being honest with you. I'm not blowing smoke, you know. And it's true. But Chance nailed it. He says, "You think it's maybe your name?" I said, "Yeah, I think so.
I'm not blind to the fact that people know you, but you're known. I think you're known. The expression that you deliver when you get into this quiet, hushed place with your voice is really, really distinctive.
Right.
And I needed someone who could do that better, I think, better than I could. Like I said, there was only a few guys I could think of. So even if I had never planned to go and do anything with that, which I do and still working on it, I still wanted you to sing it.
Right. Well, I appreciate that. And I had a blast doing it. And I think it's a beautiful song. It really is very moving, lyrically extremely moving. And a beautiful song. It is musically, it's beautiful. So the whole album, you did it's a great job. It really is a true testament.
Thank you. Yeah. So my last frivolous question is this. I believe the story on how you came by the nickname Pirate is from Jordan.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've got this extraordinary tattoo.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's where it is right there, man.
Yeah, it's like freaking... Yeah, it's pretty crazy. But what happened was that, like, I have a propensity to really kind of wear my heart in my sleeve sometimes. And I become an extremely moody, emotional person. And I guess Jordan one day, like, we were on tour. And this is what we were talking about earlier, Peter, is that there's so many demands on a vocalist. There's demands on the whole band, you know, physically, everything, but vocalist, you're dealing with a lot of stuff all the time, because environments are what you're extremely sensitive to, whether it's too cold or it's too hot or it's too dry or it's too wet or whatever, you know. You got to find that perfect that balance, basically. And I always have this tendency on the road, and the guys kind of sense it. They know that I can be getting into a mood. And so one day, this is many years ago, and I got on the bus and the guy's like, "Hey man, what's up?" And I'm like, "Hey," you know, and I just kept going on my way. And Jordan yelled, "Hey Pirate, you think you're going to have a couple words for us at some point today?" And I said, "Hey, you might want to just leave things well enough alone." Right. So he just started calling me Pirate from that moment on, whenever he'd see that I was a little edgy. And then the other guys did too. They go, "Oh, here comes the Pirate," you know. And then it was just kind of something that just morphed from there. It was really funny. And then everybody's aware of it out there. And then I even have a lot of fans when we were doing the meet and greets, "Hey, Pirate, Pirate." They wouldn't even call me James, Pirate. It was really funny. And then, you know, as the years went on, about 10 years ago, I started thinking, "Oh, you know, I do want to get at least one tattoo." And I did, and not 10 years ago, but, you know, like the original one. I don't know if you can see
right.
it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is, like, you know, the whole pirate ship thing, right? And then when I did that, then I started just thinking about, well, I'm going to do at least one more, and, you know, it's just going to be something that really is like a broad stroke of the alter ego or whatever it is, you know. And so it was cool. It's just something that Jordan started calling me, and bang bang, here we are today. I'm the Pirate.
I love the tattoo is beautiful. Yes.
Oh, thank you.
Folks want to see it. There's you can Google it. Get a really, there's a
well the, and the tattoo artist too, his name is Peter, if you can believe this. Peter Tatter.
Really?
And he's a tatter. He's a tatter. Yeah, but it's a T-A-T-T-E-R. And you want to look at his work. I am not kidding. When I saw this guy's portfolio, I was blown away. There's some of this stuff that you would swear to God it's going to reach out and grab you. It looks alive. It looks, it's animated, you know, so to speak. His work is phenomenal. So when I saw this guy's portfolio, I was just like, "Oh my God, no, this is the guy I got to get." And I need to go to him. Yeah.
There's a big face that looks like an elderly man in a little lower. Who is that? And the tattoo.
Oh, well, there's no, it's, well, that's, that's just like for, like that's just like a play with the Pirates of the Caribbean, you know. Oh. And what's his name, Davy? Oh shit, what was? I can't remember the freaking. Yeah, Davy Jones. Thank you. Yeah. So that it was like kind of a play there. I just said kind of loosely base it on that, you know, on him. And he was like, oh, no problem. He says, I love that stuff. And yeah, so it's all cool. It's good stuff. Yeah.
It's a colorful thing. I actually do have one last question. And it's we've covered a whole bunch of your career, mm-hmm. which has just spanned so many projects and flavors and expressions of your musical self.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I wish I'd asked about Nat King Cole. We'll talk about him another time.
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, I mean, let's definitely do this again. I mean, I've had a lot of fun doing this for sure.
But I want to know and leave people who are watching and will see this on YouTube and everywhere else. What's the next, is there a mountain, a creative mountain that you want to climb? It could be a kind of music that you've not done before, or theater, or completely not music, but some creative endeavor that is a hobby or an interest that time allows you'd love to, you know, realize?
I've been talking for many years about doing like a Broadway play, you know, and I'd still love to do that before I retire. And so, whether it's, you know, I'm waving at Chance and his friends, whether it's something where I do, you know, I would love to do Les Miserables, just because I think vocally it's a stellar production, or even, you know, The Phantom. I could see myself just getting really into play. And I think when I did, Theater Equation in 2015 for Arjen Lucassen, and that was based off Human Equation. I mean, I had such a great time doing that production. And we only did, two, three shows. And it was, you know, I just really, really had such a great experience with it. I found it very moving, very satisfying. And so if anything, you know, I would like to do something like that, where I maybe just do a 3-month residence somewhere. And I would do that character, whatever it might be. One of those, you know, like if something else came by that I thought was vocally something that would be extremely satisfying and would create that other accolade for me, I would definitely jump at the opportunity. But the thing that's always worked, and I shouldn't say against me, but the thing that has always prevented me from doing such a an endeavor is because, you know, when I'm in a band called Dream Theater, and when we tour extensively, and we tour for quite some time, and when I'm not with them, then I like to, you know, balance things, and I have a wife and I have a family, and I like to do other things. I love downhill skiing. I love, you know, there's other things I like to do in life. So there's only so much time.
You gotta have balance. Well, I hope at some point maybe the conditions are right, because I think you'd be amazing, and I think you'd actually also be amazing at the Jekyll and Hyde show we talked about earlier, because have the ability to really differentiate the characters. They had another guy from your past that I know you've crossed paths with, Sebastian Bach. Played.
I knew you were going to say that. Yeah.
But they, you know, you would kill that. Maybe you could be part of the revival for it.
Yeah, maybe. You see, that's what I'm talking about. So something like that, you know. I wish that I had done, back in my 20s, man, I wish that I'd done something like Jesus Christ Superstar. That would have been freaking amazing to do something like that. It's funny, because I remember, I know Sebastian well, and we have gotten together here and there, and we partied together in the past and all that stuff. And I remember when he got that gig, and I thought, he's going to do it justice, because he can sing clean, and then he can have that rasp and that, you know, that balls and the power. So it was really cool to see him get that. And he did a good job. He did a great job. Yeah.
Well, I hope that happens. I love theater too, which is maybe part of the reason that I adored The Astonishing so much. But I hope at some point the touring or something just conspires to give you a shot at something like that. I think it'd be amazing.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
Well, thanks again, my friend, for all of this time. I've learned a bunch in this conversation, and all of the folks who are watching with us now and who'll see this later, I really encourage you to dive into not just the Dream Theater stuff, but all this. I mean, just go to the Wikipedia page. The number of collaborations and appearances and solo work is stunning. And if you appreciate what James does as a vocalist, you're just in for so many treats. I reacquainted myself with so much of it over the last few days, and just reaffirmed why you are my North Star as a vocalist. Like, you're the guy that makes me want to get better.
Thank you, man. Well, I tell you, I don't even know if I'm going to be able to get out of the basement here. My head's too big.
Well, I think about these things when I say them. They're not, it's not.
I sincerely appreciate that. Thank you, man. No, I really do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'll leave you to your family and your day. Thanks again, James. We'll stay in touch.
Awesome. Thank you, Peter. This has been a lot of fun, and definitely let's do it again. Absolutely.
All right. Take care, my friend.
All right, man. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.